Hello, and welcome back to Weird on the Rocks. This is a podcast that explores the weird, unusual, strange, and unexplained, all while getting our drink on. I'm your host, Katie. So today's episode is going to be one that I find really fascinating, and that is people who have gone missing in the wilderness, basically without a trace. And more specifically, a lot of them have gone missing in our national parks. I first heard about this topic when I listened to a podcast interview with a man named David Politis, who has dedicated a lot of his life and career into looking into these missing people. He has written numerous books about the topic and has two documentaries out called Missing 411 and Missing 411 The Hunted, both of which I recommend if you're wanting to learn more about this topic. I think like most of us, I wasn't aware of the fact that so many people in our country have gone missing under such bizarre and similar circumstances. About a year ago, I received a message from someone who suggested that I cover this topic, and they were especially interested because they were from one of the areas near Yosemite National Park that has a large number of missing people. I have family in this area, actually, and I visited it often growing up, so I was very intrigued to learn more about this topic. But like with a lot of the topics I cover, this one just has so much information, and I knew I was going to have to put in a lot of time and energy, and sometimes it's just really hard to motivate myself to do things, especially being pregnant. But I thought now was the time. It's been on my list for a really long time, and so I figured it was just time to dive in and do it and dedicate the time to it. This episode is going to start off with me telling the stories of several individuals who have gone missing in similar ways. And at the end, I will get into some of the theories behind these disappearances. And I'm also going to share some tips on how you can stay safe the next time you're outdoors. You can find Weird on the Rocks on Facebook and Instagram at Weird on the Rocks Podcast, Twitter at Weird_Rocks, and the website weirdontherocks.weebly.com. Please subscribe wherever you're listening now so you always get the newest episode right when it's released. Today's episode is sponsored by Two Beauties Skincare and Makeup. Do you love beauty? Do you love supporting local business? Two Beauties Skin and Makeup, located in the heart of Old Town Eureka, is your one-stop destination for all things beauty on the North Coast. They offer clinical skincare services, chemical peels, waxing, and professional makeup application from licensed and experienced professionals only. Two Beauties also carries a large selection of high-end makeup and skincare products like Jan Marini, Glow Skin Beauty, Kula, and Oma Beauty, to name a few. I actually recently placed an order on their awesome new website. It looks great. And I got a message from the owner, Liz, asking about the color of concealer that I had selected for myself. She said that she pulled up my records from when I had my wedding makeup done, which was over 2 years ago, and that I am a few shades lighter than what I had selected, and that she could just replace the shade for me if I wanted her to. I was really honestly blown away by this attention to detail and the fact that she went through the trouble of doing all of that just to make sure that I received a product that I was happy with. So many businesses would just see me as, you know, money coming in and not care about my order or if I was, you know, ordering the wrong shade. But she took the time to make sure I was going to be happy with the product I received, which I was. And I can't believe how far off I was with my selection. I have to keep reminding myself that I'm very pale. I do not, in fact, have a tan. And honestly, over the years, I have ordered so much makeup that is the wrong shade and doesn't work with my skin. And I end up just not using it or giving it away. And this is why some things really should be left to the experts. If you want to shop somewhere with above and beyond customer service and that you know your money is going to a small woman-owned business, then you absolutely need to check out Two Beauties. Easily shop gift cards and all your beauty needs at www.twobeauties.org. That's TWOBeauties.org. Or find them on social media at Two Beauties Eureka. Love beauty, shop local. Two Beauties in Old Town Eureka since 2016. Before we get into the good stuff, I want to share this week's beverage of choice. Tonight I'm drinking yet another alcohol-free wine, because baby. And this one is a rosé by the brand Free. It's F-R-E. I tried a white wine a while ago that was awful. I had to pour it down the drain, but this one is actually pretty good, and I feel kind of fancy drinking it out of a wine glass, feeling like the good old days. If you're looking for a decent alcohol-free wine, I would definitely recommend this one, and I found it at my local BevMo. All right, well, let's get into it. Cheers, and let's get weird. David Politis had been researching Bigfoot for years, including writing several books about the topic. His work took him all over the country, chasing stories and hoping to see the elusive creature for himself. One day, while visiting a national park for work, he was approached by an off-duty park ranger. The man was familiar with David's work, but he didn't want to talk about Bigfoot. Instead, he asked David if he was aware of the large number of people who go missing within national parks. David was not aware of this issue, but with a 20-year law enforcement career and someone who prides himself on discovering the truth, he decided to look into it for himself. The information he discovered would lead him down an investigative path that he is still following. And he would realize that not only were people disappearing in national parks, but from rural and wilderness areas all over the country. And for most, there was no logical explanation why. One of David's first tasks was to speak to those who run the national parks and to get more information about the number of missing people and the details around their disappearances. To his shock, nobody could provide this information to him. In his 2016 documentary, Missing 411, Politis spoke to then-Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, who oversaw the national parks. When Politis asked exactly how many people have gone missing from national parks, Salazar said, quote, "I don't recall," end quote. The parks were able to provide inventory lists, including how many rolls of toilet paper they had on site, and commercial use lists, including names and dates of movies filmed on national park land. But there was not a list with the names of those who had gone missing while in the parks, or at least they weren't giving it to David. David was using the Freedom of Information Act to request information from the parks, which, according to Wikipedia, is, quote, "a federal freedom of information law that requires the full or partial disclosure of previously unreleased information and documents controlled by the United States government upon request," end quote. One way to request information is to be a published author and to use the information for educational purposes. David explained that he was indeed a published author, but the officials at the park said that his books weren't available in enough libraries to qualify him to receive the information. This is not a law, and David pushed the issue, to which the officials said that it was an internal policy of theirs, and they wouldn't be giving David the information he was seeking in order to carry out his investigation. In the years since he began researching the topic, he has offered to provide unpaid interns to the national parks to upload Excel onto their computers and manually enter the data about the missing people, but none of the parks have taken him up on his offer. In 2011, David started the Can-Am Missing Project. Can-Am, standing for Canada and America. The project catalogs missing people in the wilderness of North America who disappeared under mysterious circumstances. Currently, there are over 1,600 names on the list. Over the years, David has been able to find patterns and trends in the details surrounding many of these disappearances. Some of these similarities include dogs not being able to track a scent, many people disappearing in the later afternoon, bodies being found with their clothing and shoes removed, bodies being discovered in areas already thoroughly searched, remains being found in or near boulder fields, some type of weather event happening around the time of the disappearance, or beginning of the search, including a dust storm, rain, or snow, the person suffering from some type of disability or illness, or being very young or elderly, remains being found huge distances away from the point of last being seen, and 80% of people going missing within 200 miles of a large body of water. David has also found 59 clusters of where people disappear, with a cluster being defined as four or more people going missing in one area. The biggest clusters of disappearances in the United States are in Yosemite National Park, Crater Lake, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, and Rocky Mountain National Park. He believes that the national parks are not more forthcoming with the information regarding missing people on their land because they don't want to scare away the public and make them think that visiting a park could be dangerous. But it leaves the question, why and how are so many people going missing, essentially without a trace? It was 2015, and 19-year-old college student Joseph Keller was spending the summer on a road trip with friends Colin and Christian. They had visited San Francisco, Las Vegas, and the Grand Canyon, and ended up at Joe's aunt's and uncle's ranch in the San Juan Mountains of Colorado, part of the Rio Grande National Forest. Joe was a competitive swimmer and runner and on the community college cross-country team. He and his friend Colin decided to go for an hour-long run, a routine activity for the two of them. Joe left his phone at the ranch, was shirtless and wearing shorts, shoes, and a watch. Neither of them were familiar with the area or accustomed to the altitude, which was 9,000 feet. They eventually settled into their paces with Colin running ahead. At one point, Colin saw a fly fisherman who recalls seeing Colin 2.5 miles up the road from the ranch, but he never saw Joe. Colin returned to the ranch and waited for Joe, but an hour later, he still hadn't returned. By dinner time, he still hadn't arrived, and Colin and Christian were concerned. They drove around honking and yelling, hoping to maybe find Joe injured somewhere. A few ranch hands from the area became aware of the search and pitched in, and by 9:30 that night, 35 people were searching for Joe. Joe's uncle David said, quote, "If he was hurt, he would have heard us. He was either not conscious or not there," end quote. Later, search and rescue expert and author of the book Lost Person Behavior, Robert Koster, consulted on this case and said that it wouldn't be unusual for someone young and in good shape like Joe to switch from running to scramble mode and head up to higher ground once he realized he was lost. Around midnight, which was now Joe's 20th birthday, the Conejos County Sheriff's Department was called and Sheriff Howard Galvez came to the ranch. Joe's parents in Tennessee were also called and started their trip out west. Around 6 a.m. that morning, with Joe missing for 18 hours, the professional search began. There were 200 searchers on foot, horse, and ATV, as well as 15 dogs and infrared airplanes. Community members pitched in to help, including a man who flew his personal plane over the area and another who volunteered his drone. A $10,000 reward for information regarding Joe's disappearance was also posted. After several days of finding nothing, many of the searchers went home. They found nothing, no articles of clothing, blood, hair, or other signs of Joe in the area. Soon, the media got hold of the story and people began offering their advice and opinions. A psychic reached out to the family via Facebook, saying she saw a vision of Joe in Sedona, Arizona. And an online rumor started that Joe was abducted and harvested for his organs to sell on the black market. Joe's family began to feel frustrated and hopeless with the lack of help being offered. But with cases like these, the resources remain local unless the disappearance is considered to be of criminal nature. Robert Koster says, quote, "There are no federal standards for terrestrial search and rescue. Very few states have standards. A missing person is a local problem. It's a historical institution from when the sheriff was the only organized government. And when it comes to the locals riding to your rescue, there's a vast spectrum of capability," end quote. In fact, the Rio Grande National Forest only has one full-time law enforcement officer, and a ranger in the park named Andrea Jones even told Outside.com that she sometimes first hears of search and rescue efforts in the local paper. And, quote, "On occasions, when we initially learn about a search and rescue in the forest from the local media, it's difficult for us to properly engage, communicate, and offer available knowledge or resources," end quote. On August 4th, 13 days after Joe went missing, the search was called off. Sheriff Galvez felt as though all their resources had been exhausted. Divers and boats had searched the rivers, brush was removed and looked under, vacant cabins were searched, campground toilets were emptied, and they even took samples of animal droppings found nearby. But there was no trace of Joe. The Keller family decided to hire two different private investigators, both of which found absolutely nothing. And one even admitted that he had never worked a case with less information to go on. After 2 weeks of Joe being missing, Alamosa County Undersheriff Sean Woods spoke with the Keller family and told them of a local man named Alan Duffy, a 71-year-old man who worked as a tracker. In fact, Alan had even worked the JonBenet Ramsey case, scouring her neighborhood with his dog for clues. Duffy agreed to work the case and was given one of Joe's dirty socks for his bloodhound named RC to smell. 4.5 miles up the road from the ranch, RC alerted near a pond and went into the water and sat. Duffy said that scent is often drawn to water, so it doesn't necessarily mean that there was something in the water, but perhaps there were human remains nearby. The area had already been searched, including divers in the pond, but was searched again and nothing was found. Over the next few years, searches continued, including a search conducted by the John Francis Foundation, which is a nonprofit that helps families look for their missing loved ones. The founder, David Francis, whose own son, John, had gone missing in 2006, said, quote, "If you go missing in a poor county, you're going to get a short, somewhat sloppy search. In my mind, that's the national disgrace. Everybody knows someone with cancer, but it's a minority who knows someone who's gone missing," end quote. Then in August of 2016, John Rienstra, a former Pittsburgh Steelers lineman and a search and rescue volunteer, found Joe's remains in a boulder field, 1.7 miles from his aunt and uncle's ranch. Rienstra said, quote, "I heard there had been a lot of searching for 2.5 miles. I started looking for rapids, caves, cliffs, of course, and right at 2.5 miles, there's a place to pull off the road, and there were cliffs close by. It took me about an hour to get up there to the base of the cliff, and I went left until I ran out of room. Then I turned around and went back toward the ranch on the base of the cliffs, and I found him," end quote. The area was too rugged for dog or horse search teams, and the specific spot where his remains were found had not been searched, although Joe's dad had gotten within a few hundred yards of it. The terrain of loose rocks was so rugged that he assumed Joe would have not been able to make it up there. Joe's family and dedicated locals who volunteered hundreds of hours are still confused as to how or why Joe would have climbed the rocky cliffside. Joe's mother says that his behavior doesn't make sense for what was supposed to be a casual hour-long run before dinner, and explained that Joe was very tired from driving the night before and having cut wood right before the run. She also said that Joe was not a climber and was afraid of heights. Everyone involved, including Sheriff Galvez, is also confused as to why the search dogs did not track Joe's scent up the hill or alert near the area when they had been close, or why the drone, airplane, or helicopter didn't see Joe's body or bright red shorts after flying over that exact area. It was November 15th, 2015, and 82-year-old Tom Messick was going hunting with his son and a few buddies in northeastern New York. Tom, who had three sons, was always an outdoorsman and enjoyed hunting, boating, and fishing. Over the years, he taught hunter safety and survival classes in his community and was also an Army veteran. Tom was known as the guy you would go to with any wilderness questions. By 2015, at the age of 82, Tom had some vision problems and couldn't hear out of one ear, but was still in good shape and able to get around easily. The Messick family, along with four other families, owned a cabin in Brant Creek, where they would meet up yearly for a week of fishing and hunting. On this particular fall day, a group of seven of them decided to do a short afternoon hunt, including Tom's son, who was in his 40s. They decided to try out a new location called Lily Pond, where none of the men had hunted before. They drove up a 2-mile dirt road and parked right by the small lake. The four oldest men, all in their 80s, only walked into the woods about 40 yards and sat down on rocks or leaned against trees. They acted as the watchers and stayed in their spot while the younger men approached from the other side of the lake, hoping to drive any deer or wildlife to the older men that were waiting. Tom was wearing a plaid cap, a jacket, pants, and boots. His wife said that he took his job as watcher very seriously and would not have left his spot. He had a walkie-talkie, a rifle, and a Snickers bar. All of the men had walkie-talkies and were on the same channel. The hunt lasted 2 hours, and they saw no wildlife and decided over the walkie-talkies to return to the vehicles. But Tom didn't show up. Around this time, one of the men, Sid Sharp, told the group that he had heard an odd sound in the woods while they were watching. It was very quick but very loud and sounded almost as though a large trap was snapping shut. The men began looking for Tom, including firing shots into the air and calling out his name. Eventually, one of the men decided to alert the ranger. Several of the men stayed at the park truck all night, calling for Tom, honking and shooting into the air. The next day, the local authorities were alerted and a search party was organized by the New York State Forest Rangers. Warren County Under Sheriff Sean Lamore said that the area they searched seemed almost void of all wildlife, and they didn't even see a squirrel, which was very odd. State police, several volunteer fire departments, New York Correctional Department, and even the National Guard were all called in, using infrared helicopters. The thought was that maybe Tom had got to the road and was hit by a car, so they checked all the roads and ditches nearby, but nothing was found. They walked through the woods and organized sections using bump lines, which was string tied to trees to show what areas had already been combed through. After an area was searched one way, they would return and search it going the other way. So all areas were searched both horizontally and vertically. At one point, there was over 300 people looking for Tom. Nothing was found. Not his gun, walkie-talkie, articles of clothing, or his candy wrapper. After 4 days, two FBI agents arrived, which is unusual because the FBI usually does not participate in missing persons cases unless it's considered criminal in nature. The two agents said that they were monitoring the situation and conducted interviews and took notes. In the documentary Missing 411, The Hunted, David Politis states that his team found reports dating back to the 1960s that show that the FBI has monitored numerous other missing persons cases that are similar to the case of Tom Messick. After 10 days of searching, the formal search was called off. Nothing was found. Some think that perhaps Tom had a heart attack or some other health issue and died at his spot. However, the area was searched thoroughly. If he would have died there and been dragged off by an animal, his gun or walkie-talkie or some fragment of clothing would have been found. If an animal would have attacked him, he most likely would have shot at it, but no shots were heard by the nearby men. Others theorize that perhaps a tree fell on him and he was trapped underneath it, or that he fell into a sinkhole or tight crevice of some sort, although tracking dogs never followed any scent. Tom's son, Rob, who was on the hunt with him that day, is still utterly perplexed by the whole situation, saying, quote, "You really do never know. They say you should always go in prepared. I mean, we treated that hunt just like we were going out in the backyard. I mean, it was really nothing. You just don't expect it," end quote. Another odd detail about the disappearance of Tom Messick is that 9 days after he went missing, a man named Fred Drum, aged 68, went missing from Schuylerville, New York, just 50 miles from where Tom went missing. In fact, several individuals were pulled off the Messick case and sent to work the Drum case. On Thanksgiving Day, Fred's wife had gone to run an errand and came home to find her husband not home with his car still in the driveway. To this day, he has also never been found. In the Santa Fe National Forest, 15 people have gone missing in the 1.6 million acres of wilderness. One of these individuals was Audrey Kaplan, aged 75, who went missing July 30th, 2014. Audrey went to a shut-down ski resort with her husband to look for mushrooms, something they often did together. While looking around, the two got separated and Audrey couldn't be found. It was a very hot and dry day, but that night there was an unexpected thunderstorm. The search for Audrey went on for 5 days when a volunteer who was actually searching outside of the designated search area found a deceased Audrey, naked and laying in the fetal position in 4 inches of water. The coroner's report stated, quote, "Although there was no specific autopsy findings to indicate hypothermia, the circumstances of Ms. Kaplan's death and lack of dental disease at autopsy support cold exposure due to the very low temperature at night," end quote. So although there was no physical evidence of hypothermia, that was still what he believes killed her. The coroner also stated that there were no injuries present, and due to how her body was found, he did not believe that drowning was a possibility. A few years prior to Audrey's mysterious death, another person went missing just a few miles from where Audrey was found. 61-year-old Melvin Nadell had met up with 2 friends in the Elk Mountain area to hunt for elk and deer. They decided that Mel was going to stay near the truck because he had a knee injury, and the other 2 men would head out further. Mel's wife, Edna, said that Mel wasn't a particularly active guy and would have stayed near the truck, especially with his knee injury. When the 2 other men returned a few hours later and expecting to find Mel in or near the truck, he wasn't around. They began calling for him and shooting into the air. Another hunter came along with a satellite phone, and they called the ranger, who initiated a search. Dogs, helicopters, and search and rescue were brought in. Mel had both a bow and a pistol on him, both of which were never found, and the dogs were not able to track his scent. The only trace of Mel that was found was what looked like a makeshift hunting blind that he had made not far from where the truck was parked. The search was called off after 6 days. Mel was nowhere to be found. His GPS device was found in his truck, which David Politis says he believes points to the fact that Mel was not planning on going far from the truck, or he would have taken it with him. So if there's no evidence of him leaving the immediate area, what could have happened to him? A few years later, just 10 miles from where Melvin Nadell disappeared in the Boreas Peak area, 54-year-old Stanley Vigil was hunting with his dad and a friend. They were doing truck hunting, driving around with their guns out the windows, waiting to see a deer or elk. Eventually, a deer ran out in front of them, so Stanley jumped out of the vehicle to chase it. His father said that soon after Stanley entered the woods following the deer, that it started to rain and a heavy fog rolled in. The 2 men waited a while, hoping that Stanley would return, telling them that he had killed the deer, but he never came back. They parked the truck and went looking for him, calling his name, but Stanley couldn't be found. They called the authorities and a 7-day search commenced. Once again, dogs could not track his scent, and helicopters couldn't find anything. 5 months later, an off-duty New Mexico police officer and his son were fishing, and they found Stanley's body, 9 miles from where he went missing. A cause of death could not be determined. In September of 2014, 38-year-old Aaron Hedges went elk hunting in the Crazy Mountains of Montana with 2 friends. The mountain range is believed to be called the Crazies because the Crow tribe placed a curse upon the mountains to have extreme weather and wind that would drive the white man crazy and disorient them to ensure that they would return back and not come onto their land. Aaron and his 2 friends had 2 horses and a mule with them. They parked and headed in to Campfire Lake for a week-long hunt. As they were walking in, they had what the undersheriff, Alan Roenberg, referred to as a horse wreck, where their mule got spooked and threw all their supplies and gear off the trail, including Aaron's sleeping bag. Eventually, they got to their destination, and Aaron agreed to make the small trek up to where the men had hidden a cache of supplies the last time they hunted in the area. Aaron's friend Chris said that Aaron was an extremely smart and logical guy and knew the area well. The trip should have taken Aaron about an hour, and he would have followed a trail that was a bit overgrown, but one that he had taken many times. However, after 2 hours, Aaron hadn't returned, and his friends became concerned. Chris decided to call Aaron on a GPS phone, which showed Aaron's coordinates, but they were not able to speak with him. His friends noticed that it showed that Aaron was off of the main trail that he should have been following. The weather that day was warm and dry, and there shouldn't have been anything covering the trail, so they were confused as to how he had gotten so off track. By the morning, Aaron still hadn't returned. His friends were concerned, but figured that he would show up eventually, and knew that he was an experienced hunter and outdoorsman. But that night, a snowstorm rolled in, dumping 18 inches of snow. The friends knew that they now needed to alert the authorities. Park County officials came out and started a search, beginning where the GPS device had placed Aaron 2 days prior. The search included scent dogs, people on foot, and infrared helicopters. On the second day of the search, after Aaron had been missing for 4 days, his boots were found. They were found standing upright, side by side, and looked like they had purposely been placed there. Near that area, they then found the water bladder that would have been inserted into a camelback for drinking water, and a fire pit that had a semi-burned box of the brand of cigarettes Aaron smoked. They also found 2 backpack waistband straps. Undersheriff Alan Romberg believes that Aaron might have taken the straps off because in the cushioned part that sits on the hips, there is some padding, and that Aaron might have cut them open and used them to keep his fingers warm. He also says that searchers had been in that exact spot 2 days earlier and did not see the boots or fire pit. He assumed that Aaron removing his boots indicated hypothermia and that he couldn't have gone far. The area surrounding the boots and fire pit were searched several more times, but nothing was found. After a week, the search for Aaron was officially called off. 9 months later, in June of 2015, Charlie Rien, who owns a ranch in the area, was fixing up a fence on his property when he looked down and saw an orange vest. Then, nearby, he also found Aaron's backpack with his ID inside. Charlie immediately recognized the name and knew that this was the hunter who had gone missing in the area. Aaron's backpack was leaning against a tree under some branches and had Aaron's gun, water, still inside. He also found an open thermos and an energy drink can on a boulder nearby. Alan Romberg's first thought upon knowing of these discoveries was, quote, "What the hell was this guy doing? From where the cup is, you can see the Rayan's buildings," end quote. Meaning that from where Aaron's thermos and backpack were found, he would have been able to see the Rayan's ranch and the road leading to their property. Nothing else was found for a year. Then in 2016, a guest who was staying at the Rien Ranch found a skull. Other remains, his cell phone, and pelvis bone were later found. To this day, no pants, socks, or foot bones have ever been found. Aaron's backpack and remains were found 11 miles from where the GPS device last placed him, and 6 miles from where his boots were found. There is no explanation as to how, if Aaron was hypothermic when he took his boots and backpack straps off, that he was able to travel 6 miles to the Rayan property barefoot and that he would not try to seek help. Undersheriff Alan Romberg said, quote, "None of it makes any sense," end quote. In October of 1999, 3-year-old Jaron Atadero was visiting the Comanche Peak Wilderness area with his dad Alan and his sister Jocelyn. Alan owned the Pudere Canyon Resort, a small 10-acre resort with a store and lodging. At the time, a Christian singles group was staying there and had stayed there in the past, and Alan knew several of them well. Jocelyn, who was 6, wanted to join them on a hike, and 3-year-old Jared said he wanted to go too. The group drove 15 miles to the Big South Trailhead. Alan described the trail as moderate, with some hills and steep areas, but you could bring kids if you keep an eye on them. One woman took on the role of being with the kids and ended up ahead of the group because Jared was excited and running ahead. They eventually all met up and sat down for a break, and the woman realized it had been about 10 minutes since she last saw Jared, who had been running around and playing. People walked up and down the trail hoping to find him playing, but he was not found. It was later discovered that 2 fishermen saw Jared alone, and he asked if there were bears there. One of the group members went back to the resort where Alan was cleaning and told him that Jared was okay, but they couldn't find him. Alan immediately drove up the road to the area, and he remembers crying and yelling out to God to please help him. Eventually, the authorities were contacted and 65 search and rescue professionals were deployed to look for Jared. The search went for 24 hours a day for 8 days. They searched under brush, in animal dens, and divers searched the river. Soon, the media got hold of the story and even CNN had cameras stationed in the area. The searches eventually ended. Nothing was found for 3.5 years. Then in 2003, Robert Osborne and Gareth Watts were on a hike and had actually been talking about Jared Atadero and speculating on what might have happened to the young boy. They decided to hike up a steep, rocky embankment to see if there was a good view from the top. They said the terrain was extremely rugged and they had a difficult time not falling as their feet were continuously slipping in the loose rocks. When they got to the top of the hillside, they noticed a child's shoe sitting in the rocks. They said it looked new, with no marks or discoloration. They then found a child's jacket. The two men immediately knew what they had found and left the area and called the police. Once officials came out to the area, they conducted a search and also found a pair of pants inside out, a child's skull, and a tooth sitting on top of a log. All of the clothing and remains were determined to belong to 3-year-old Jared. Hikers Rob Osborne and Gareth Watts believed that it would have been impossible for a 3-year-old to hike up that rocky hillside. Sheriff Bill Nelson was perplexed by the findings, as he was adamant that the embankment had been thoroughly searched 3 years prior. Several volunteers who had been part of the initial searches also stated that they remember searching that area, and those items had not been there. Sheriff Bill Nelson concluded that a mountain lion must have taken his body away and buried him after killing him, and then left the area because the commotion from the searches scared it away. However, Jared's father, Alan, does not believe this, because Jared's clothes were tested and no animal hair, blood, or DNA was found on them. Alan said, quote, "I hear constantly about a mountain lion. Yes, when they tested Jared's clothing, there was no mountain lion hairs. No DNA, no blood, nothing on his clothing. The clothing was sent to the CBI. The clothing was tested by the CBI. No mountain lion hairs, no blood, nothing on any of the articles of clothing. The clothing and shoe were found in almost perfect condition, where a mountain lion attack would have torn his clothing. In one of the reports, a person says the reason we didn't find any DNA or blood or anything on Jared's clothes is because either he or something removed his clothing before he was attacked." End quote. In Sonora, California, an hour from Yosemite National Park, is the Donnell Vista. This lookout gives views of a water reservoir 1,200 feet below and has a small parking lot for people to park their cars in and get out to take photos of the canyon below. On October 3, 2016, Breck Phelps didn't show up for his church services as planned. His pastor, who was also a close friend, remembered Breck mentioning he was going fishing in the Donnell Vista area the day before. He drove out to the Vista and found Breck's car near the parking lot, parked off the side of the road, most likely because the lot was full. But there was no Breck to be found. The pastor alerted authorities, who began an official search, but it was called off after 5 days of finding nothing. In 2014 and 2005, two other people disappeared under similar circumstances. In 2014, Patricia Tolhurst's car was found in the parking lot with her purse still inside, but she was never seen again. And in 2005, Nita Mayo's car was also found in the same parking lot, with her purse and personal belongings still in her car, but Nita was also never found. Official searches of the surrounding area and river below were conducted for both women, but neither of their bodies or any belongings have ever been found. Within 11 years, three people disappeared without a trace from the exact same spot. Giuseppe Recapito, the crime reporter for the Union Democrat in Sonora, said that the sheriff's office has remained quiet about these disappearances and doesn't like to speculate about missing people. Recapito also said that in 2016, just before Breck Phelps went missing, they found human remains in the area, but they did not belong to Nita Mayo or Trisha Holhurst, meaning that yet another person had gone missing in the area. The remains were never identified. David Politis explains that if you look at a map of the area and zoom out of the Vista area, there is another small cluster nearby where three other people also went missing without a trace. And then if you zoom out even more, there is Yosemite National Park, which has the biggest cluster of missing people in a national park, with 30 people currently considered missing. This area is considered a hot spot for people disappearing and never being found. Almost directly in the middle of the area is an old hunting camp that was established in the 1950s, where hunters over the years have had strange experiences. Although the current members don't want to reveal exactly where the camp is, they say the trail in is 8 miles and it must be taken by horse or mule and has a 4,000-foot elevation change. Ron Moorhead was one of the founding members of the camp, and although he stopped hunting in the late 70s, he still visits yearly. He explained that they had experienced a strange phenomena over the years, but being professional hunters and more serious type men, they kept it to themselves. He said the first time he experienced the odd sound was in 1971, and they continued to hear the same sound for years after. Ron has been able to record the sounds several times, and I am now going to play a clip of his recordings. Wanting a scientific explanation, they sent the audio to Dr. R. Lynn Curlin, a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Wyoming. He concluded that the sounds were made by a creature larger than man based on pitch and sound, and there was more than one creature recorded. He also concluded that the tapes had not been altered in any way. Ron Moorhead also stated that he and the other men have seen strange lights in the sky over the camp, including silent blue orbs flying overhead. In 2016, Ron was visiting the camp with his wife when they witnessed a blue light floating through their camp, which he described as looking like a horizontal lightsaber from Star Wars. Ron explained that he used to be unsure about sharing these things, but as he's gotten older, he doesn't care and just wants this mystery to be solved. Along with these stories are countless others of those who have gone missing in the wilderness without a trace. Stories of people who turn around and find that their loved one or friend isn't standing there anymore. People disappearing without even a sock to be found or a scent for a dog to follow. Journalist and host of the well-known radio show Coast to Coast AM, George Knapp, said it's as if people are, quote, snatched out of the sky, end quote. And while you compare several stories to one another, you may not see any patterns. The more stories you read, more similarities are discovered. David Politis believes that many of the stories of those who have gone missing share several similar details. Some of these similarities include dogs not being able to track scents, many people disappearing in the late afternoon, bodies being found with their clothing and shoes removed, bodies being discovered in areas already thoroughly searched, remains being found in or near boulder fields, some type of weather event happening around the time of the disappearance or the beginning of the search, including a dust storm, rain, or snow, the person suffering from some type of disability or illness, or being very young or elderly, remains being found huge distances away from the point of last being seen, and 80% of people going missing within 200 miles of a large body of water. So are these really just coincidences, or is the same thing happening to all of these people? There are many theories of what could be happening out in the wilderness. David Politis believes that these clusters of missing people perhaps point to something supernatural. Those who follow his theory believe that people are disappearing more in certain areas for a reason, and there's a bigger picture as to what is happening. Many believe that a supernatural being of some sort is responsible, such as aliens or Bigfoot. Many believe that alien creatures are abducting people silently and swiftly, leaving no trace of them behind, and that perhaps they prefer more isolated areas instead of heavily populated areas where they are more likely to be seen. If aliens of this intelligence are real and visiting Earth, it is likely that they have technology vastly different from anything on Earth, and perhaps are capable of abducting people in a way that is undetectable. Many also believe that a creature such as Bigfoot may be responsible for these disappearances. Those who follow this theory like to use the audio clips recorded by Ron Moorhead as proof of this, claiming that these sounds could not have been made by man and sound like a primate. In Ron's story, and with many others, there were also mysterious lights seen, something that is common alongside Bigfoot sightings. If you want to hear more about this, listen to episode 26 about Bigfoot. Some believe that Bigfoot has been around since before man, and that they have been able to study us long enough to find ways to catch us off guard and abduct us during moments of vulnerability while out in the woods. Some also think that the Bigfoot theory would best explain how some people end up so far from their point of last communication, such as Aaron Hedges, who ended up 6 miles away from his boots, or the story of a toddler who was found 12 miles from where he disappeared. Perhaps Bigfoot, who is able to travel long distances in short periods of time, is taking these people back to their home areas. And there are also those who believe that indeed something supernatural is happening, but that a creature or alien isn't responsible. There's the belief that those who have gone missing have accidentally entered through portals into another dimension. One Reddit user even explained this phenomena as if the Earth has invisible traps set up, and when the trap is disturbed, the person is snatched up and taken into another realm of existence. And another Reddit user said, quote, "There's something in the woods, and it's intelligent enough to stay out of sight," end quote. Some believe that those whose bodies or remains are eventually found somehow didn't make it through the process of entering into the other dimension, and those who are never found have successfully made it through. And some even have combined theories, believing that perhaps aliens or a cryptid like Bigfoot actually exist in a parallel universe and are able to enter into our dimension, abduct people, and travel back. And just as there are those who stick to supernatural explanations, there are also those who try to find more rational answers. Some believe that other humans are responsible for these disappearances, whether it be serial killers who live in the isolated areas or members of groups who live on the outskirts of society. There's even the belief that these people are being abducted by cult-like groups for sacrificial reasons. Or perhaps these people were just unlucky and died because they got lost and were exposed to the elements or had an accident. Many of the 1,600 missing people were visiting new places for the first time and could have possibly got lost and, being unfamiliar with their surroundings, wandered further away without knowing it. Some believe that these people died and were taken into dens by animals or possibly fell into small crevices or under foliage where dogs couldn't track their scent. Many people who were eventually found were discovered nude with their clothes nearby, leading some to believe that hypothermia was a factor, as you feel hot and the natural instinct is to remove clothing. And while one story in particular may seem to have a plausible explanation, when looking at all the stories as a whole, it is almost impossible to find one answer as to what might really be happening to these people. Why are so many people found so far away from where they were last seen? Why are dogs often unable to track a scent? How are there no footprints left behind? And how are none of their personal belongings ever recovered? Perhaps it's something we will never know the real answer to, and maybe we're not supposed to. But one thing many can agree on is that there needs to be a better system for keeping records of those who go missing. As many families have learned, once your loved one vanishes, it is often up to you to keep the search for them a priority. In a 2017 article for Outside.com written by John Billman, he says, quote, "If you vanish in a multiplicity, the local police department is likely to look for you. The police can obtain assistance from the county sheriff or, in other cases, state police or university law enforcement. If foul play is suspected, your state's Bureau of Investigation can decide to get involved. Atop that is the FBI. With the exception of the sheriff, however, these organizations don't tend to go rifling through the woods unless your case turns into a criminal one. But all those bets are off when you disappear in the wild. While big national parks like Yosemite operate almost as sovereign states with their own crack search and rescue teams, go missing in most western states, and, with the exception of New Mexico and Alaska, statutes that date back to the Old West stipulate that you're now the responsibility of the county sheriff," end quote. Many believe that if the government kept better records of these disappearances and made these people more of a priority, that many more of them would have been found, and perhaps we would have a better idea of what is actually happening. In David Politis's most recent documentary, Missing 411, The Hunted, several wilderness experts and hobbyists were asked what we can do to better protect ourselves when entering unknown terrain. Santa Fe Guiding Company owner Rob King says that whenever going out into the wilderness, you should bring identification, extra water, a large trash bag which can be used to keep dry or to carry something, to have a satellite phone and GPS tracker, a whistle, a knife, and a fire starter in case you are lost outdoors overnight. Lauren Ellis, senior editor of Mossy Oak Gamekeepers magazine, says to wear bright colors, bring extra ammo, tell someone where you're going and when to expect you back, check the weather before you go out, and if you get lost, to stay put and not risk moving further away from those who are looking for you. And helicopter pilot and owner of Rocky Mountain Rotors, Mark Taylor, says if you get lost, to try and find a clearing without traveling too far, and to wave your clothing or whatever else you can find above your head to attract attention. Okay, so that's going to be it for today's episode. And as always, I would love to hear what you guys think and what your theories are behind this. As much as I just think that these people got lost and wandered too far away and got hurt or taken by an animal or something more logical, it's also hard to ignore some of the details surrounding these disappearances. The story of the elderly man who was sitting on a rock hunting and then was just never seen again makes me really sad, and it's very perplexing to me. They had hundreds of people searching the area, and dogs couldn't even follow a scent. So it's hard to imagine that he just fell under some brush or something. He was 82 years old. He wouldn't have gone far. And if he was attacked by an animal, you think they would have found some blood, or he would have dropped his gun or his walkie-talkie or something. He just literally vanished with people very close by to him. I just feel so sad for his son who was there that day and his wife, because it must be hard to have absolutely no closure and to always wonder what happened to your loved one and to always think the worst and think that, you know, he was in pain or something awful happened to him. The story of Aaron Hedges is also really crazy to me, mostly because he was found so far from the point of last communication and so far from where his boots were discovered. Why would he walk one direction, take off his boots, then walk 6 miles in the other direction with no shoes on? He was also a very experienced hunter and outdoorsman, so why would he have walked 11 miles so far from the area that he knew he should stay in? He then ended up close to a residence, but he didn't seek help and ended up just dying right there in view of someone's home. It just doesn't make any sense. The stories of the multiple people missing from that Vista Point area in Sonora is also really fascinating because I have family there and I've actually visited that exact lookout before. And that area really is extremely isolated. And no matter what happened to those people, it's kind of just creepy to think about that several people have gone missing in basically identical ways and just have never been found. I grew up and still live in a pretty rural area where we have woods and lakes and mountains nearby, and I think of all the places that I've been over the years where I easily could have gotten lost or disoriented or something. Just this past weekend, I went up to the mountains with my family, and I walked off the trail to go to the bathroom, and I was literally thinking about this episode, and I suddenly felt kind of scared and just really like exposed and vulnerable, which I never really feel when I'm outdoors. And as I was going to the bathroom, I was thinking like, what if I just disappeared right now? How long would it take my husband, my family to realize I was gone? Or like, how far could I have gotten before they would realize I'm gone? My dad and brother are also avid hunters, and my brother often goes on long trips all by himself in states that he's never even visited before. And writing this episode made me feel really worried about him, even though he's extremely intelligent and has lots of experience. You know, so did many of these hunters who went missing. It just makes you really think about how powerful Mother Nature really is and how sometimes no matter how prepared we are, it's no match for what might be out there. But let me know what you guys think. Do you think these people just got lost and maybe got hypothermia or got hurt and fell into the river or something? Do you think an animal got them? Or do you think something bigger than us is at play? Let me know your thoughts. You can find the show on Facebook and Instagram at Weird on the Rocks Podcast and the website weirdontherocks.weebly.com. As always, thank you so much for hanging out with me today and for supporting the show. I appreciate each and every single one of you. And until next time, cheers and stay weird.
That was a Titancast episode.